Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers. Now, for my guest today, there are 10,000 stories behind her message, but perhaps above all, one reason to listen. For the message is determined, optimistic, and empowering. And it's that this next decade of my life will be the best yet. Charlotte Keenan is the Managing Director of Goldman Sachs 10,000 Women Initiatives, providing women entrepreneurs around the world with business and management education, mentoring and networking, and access to capital. Alongside sits its sister program, 10,000 Small Businesses, which is committed to stimulating small business growth, and it provides my guests with a ringside seat into the importance of entrepreneurs to the economy and insights on how gloomy times for growth might glow again with the feel-good factor of progress and potential realised. Charlotte, welcome to Changemakers.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me. I'm very much looking forward to the conversation.
Me too. I mean, we'll declare an interest that we're working together on the, on the Help to Grow programme. More of that in a moment, but let's start there. The best is yet to come. With you, I have no doubt, but let's talk about this next decade. Why will it be the best yet?
So a friend said to me the other day, they were reading this book, 4,000 Weeks, which I think is, I haven't yet read it, but I think it's on the premise that you die around, you know, 75, 80, and we have 4,000 weeks in our life. And so I realized that I was pretty much halfway there, declaring my early 40s. If I looked ahead, based on a whole load of inspiration that I've had from people recently, I decided that this is the decade that I'm going to go for it. And I'm going to do lots of different things. I'm going to climb a mountain. I'm going to climb Mount Kilimanjaro by the time I'm 45, setting myself a ambitious physical deadline with this. And I grew up in Africa and I've always wanted to get to the top of it. And that's always been a target. I want to start my own business. You know, I spend my life looking at incredible business leaders. And the older I get, I love building things and I love creating things. And so I'm going to do that by the end of this decade. And then look, we've been through, you know, we all have a really grim few years. And so I just want to have fun in the decade ahead. So that's what I'm aiming for.
I think that's a great way to look at it. And I suppose it's also about the fact there's no point in having dreams unless we're prepared to try and live them.
Well, exactly. You know, we haven't got forever, and we don't want to get old and wish for all the things that we wanted to do and then never quite got around to. And it's also the realization, look, I've got two tiny children, a really busy job, life's really busy. But within that, we still have to make time to achieve the things that really motivate us and the things that make a difference and the things that we can, you know, when we're older, step back and talk about to our children and grandchildren.
So I'd have thought for listeners is that some people will really buy into the whole seize the day moment and may well be, you know, think we're talking at the beginning of a new year. Maybe some people are already thinking like that, but some people will find it difficult, right? You know, they'll feel that, you know, there's still a sort of a long list of problems in a lot of people's lives. I mean, as you were sort of inferring in terms of your own experience, are there tips you'd give in terms of how you get hold of, I guess, the kind of the courage to go for it?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the age old saying, right, that life goes on. It's up to us to make of it what we will. And look, I mean, the UK is in a tricky place. Economically, we're in a challenging place. You know, personally, people are just getting over the pandemic and whatever else might be going along. But I do think it's also times like this that bring about opportunity and excitement, right? And it's also a case that, you know, when times are lean or when things are difficult, that also spurs innovation, it spurs hunger, and that leads to new and different things. So that's why I'm looking forward now. And look, I mean, there's an awful lot that we need to fix and to do, right? Mm. Our political system is challenging. Economically, it's challenging. Many people are going through a very difficult cost of living crisis. And we can sit back and allow that to happen, or actually we can step forward and step up, right, and change it.
Well, one of the things about stepping forward, I guess, is something that you and I have stepped into, which is the Help to Grow management program, which is very much about helping small firms grow, get where they want to go. Let's introduce it to listeners. Tell us what it is and why it matters.
Oh, this is the most fantastic program. And Michael, I'm super privileged to lead the advisory council for it, and working with yourself, Dame Alison Rose, and many others on it. No, I mean, this is the idea that Rishi Sunak had when he was chancellor. That fundamentally, in order to spur economic growth, we need to increase the productivity of fast-growing small firms across the UK, which is an absolutely core tenet that in other areas of my life with, 10,000 small businesses is, an economic 101, right? If we help small businesses to grow, the economy grows, we're creating jobs, the ongoing multiplier effect is an extraordinary boost for economic growth. So last in 2020, the government announced Help to Grow, which I think it might be 2021. My years are running away with me. A very, very significant initiative to frankly provide business leaders and business owners with the tools and the skills that they need to help their businesses grow to the next level. So we run it in partnership with CABS, the Chartered Association of Business Schools. We've got over 56 business schools now around the country, all of whom are providing a very intensive, very dedicated course for small business owners to help them fundamentally achieve the next level of their growth. So it's an extraordinary privilege, very, very humbling, and incredibly important, because frankly, unless we're leaning into entrepreneurs and business owners, particularly at a time like this, where they need every available resource to grow and to thrive, we're in trouble.
Now, you've given one very compelling reason as to why. I've read that you've said in the past that entrepreneurs are equipped to deal with uncertainty better than most. Is this about, this is about not just about unleashing the guts to go for it, but also growing with knowledge, getting your own pocket MBA, I guess, in terms of, so is it the head and the heart that we're unleashing here, I guess?
That's a lovely way to put it, right? It's giving them the skills to unleash the head and the heart. And, entrepreneurs are ideally placed, right? I mean, the very essence of entrepreneurship is taking a risk, but you want that to be a calculated risk. And so you want to give these individuals the framework, the opportunities, the discipline, the financial discipline, that whatever they're doing, whether they're creating, taking over a business, making something more efficient, they've got the bandwidth and the opportunity to do that. And look, I mean, another fundamental component here is it's really lonely running your own business. And creating a network, therefore, of entrepreneurs across the country is a phenomenal, phenomenal resource for them to lean on each other, develop ideas, brainstorm ideas, help each other on each other's boards, etc. So it's very powerful sense of community.
Now, what I want to move on to now, I suppose, is introducing your work at Goldman Sachs. But in so doing, obviously through both 10,000 small businesses and 10,000 women, it's not just a perspective about here in the UK that you have, but indeed the global state of health of entrepreneurs and small firms, and and I guess that kind of that attitude that we're talking about. When you sort of go around the world, and I know you've done a lot in India. A lot of growth economies. Obviously, in the UK right now, we are in the grip of a very tough economic picture, as you've said. Does it feel different here, though, in your experience, in terms of the mood, the kind of the vibe, compared to some of the other countries you're working in?
Oh, yes, it does, is the short answer. Sadly, I think is the answer. So, yes, I mean, both programs, again, very similar to Help to Grow, and Goldman started them in 2007, 2008, on the back of the financial crisis, where we realised that in order to help countries grow, the single best thing that we could do philanthropically was to support small firms to become bigger firms, right? Make small big. And it's a very simple recipe, education, skills, networks, and working in collaboration with some of the world's best business schools. And capital is the missing ingredient.
But based on a belief that actually this is like a form of nation building, is it? Civil society building, that actually entrepreneurs do more than just earn a living.
They do an awful lot more than earn a living, right? They're creating jobs. The multiplier effect of those jobs they pay it forward, particularly with women, which I love when we look at the results of our 10,000 women program. You know, over 90% are paying it forward and helping other women to get jobs or other women to start businesses. So it's not just the economic success of a single entity in a single company. I mean, the ripple impact of a healthy small business, which, let's face it, is the dominant employer in any society in which, you know, small businesses in the world. But it is very different market to market at the moment. And if you mentioned India, you know, and I love spending time in India, and it's a powerful, exciting growth economy. I mean, Morgan Stanley did a fantastic research report recently talking about, you know, the next decade. You know, my decade is going to be my best yet. It's also going to be India's best decade. And just the opportunity and the, you know, the volume of small businesses, right, is really quite unparalleled. I mean, there are huge challenges, of course, you know, particularly in the field that I'm in, you know, capital for those businesses. But with the rest of the focus on India, it's hungry and there is opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I think that leads to a very, very positive momentum. Here, in some ways, I think you could say the country's feeling a bit tired, right? And that's why, you know, small businesses, engines of economic growth, they're still hungry, they're still entrepreneurial, they have to be. And actually that gives, you know, that kind of catalytic life and opportunity to the country.
It's interesting, Izzy, because I suppose when we talk about entrepreneurship and the programs in the UK, it's almost never from the perspective of actually, well, is this an effort at social as well as economic transformation? You know, a past guest on Changemakers was Professor Mohammed Yunus, the Nobel laureate, who talks, you know, really engagingly about microcredit loans for women in India in terms of just the, you know, the social passport that this led in terms of the transformation in lives. And, you know, it makes me sort of wonder the degree to which we need to have a more fundamental conversation about the fact that we're not just, you know, helping start or grow businesses, but actually this is a broader conversation about the sort of society and the sort of pathways that, you know, are created and what it means to live in a country like this.
I mean, the other point that I'd bring in there is that the UK also is leading the world in terms of how we think about supporting small businesses, right? So, I mean, Help to Grow is a world-leading program. No other country has such a thing at the scale. 10,000 small businesses and 10,000 women. You know, likewise, you know, from a private sector perspective, are leading the world. And I think we as kind of the UK can do much, much more in sharing the lessons and the evidence that we're finding from these programs. And, you know, coming to your point about civil society, you know, each of these businesses is a story of an individual. It's a story of their employees. It's a story of change. It's a story of creation. You know, my favorite question to ask our business owners is, you know, what was the moment that you decided to step back from whatever you were doing and actually set up the business and come up with the business or create the idea or improve something that someone else was doing? And that moment and what drives people to that moment, I find endlessly fascinating. And, you know, and the answers are always completely, completely different. And giving, you know, presence and showcasing and illustrating, you know, all of those thousands and thousands of stories, I don't think we do enough of, and I think it's incredibly powerful.
But there is a leap of faith that a small business leader needs to take in terms of setting something up. There is also how you maintain your sense of belief. I noted that you've spoken in the past about how in the pandemic, 60% of small businesses that you spoke to predicted they'd fail, whereas 99% survived. So this kind of sense of the difference between the anxiety about what I feel may come and then the reality of what it takes to actually show the resilience and the guts and the survival instinct to actually make it. It'd be interesting to sort of, I suppose, you know, you've sort of alluded to it, because what we're talking about here is an element of character, aren't we, in terms of what it means to go for it as a person that's going to run and grow their own business.
It's definitely, I mean, it's I think the grit to keep going, right? If you go back to the pandemic example, I mean, when we surveyed our businesses at the beginning, they were absolutely terrified. You know, at the end of it, apart from the obvious sectors, most of them had actually done extremely well. You know, I mean, they were exhausted, but those businesses had done incredibly well across the UK. And so I think it is in their character, right? I mean, it is an element of self-belief, but also humility, right? Because you need to, you know, a successful business, you need to have successful leadership teams, successful partners, successful collaborations, the kind of knowing what you don't know, right? Helps refine that opportunity. And frankly, just hard work. Mm. I mean, you were there, Michael, we did a great conference in Oxford at the end of last year about the resilient business. And we interview kind of all, you know, all of the great and the good from different spheres and different sectors. We had Marcus Waring talking about being a Michelin starred chef in the kitchen and his career, you know, Seleni Henry, many others. And the common theme is hard work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I think sometimes there's a misconception that you come up with a great idea and then the next day you're the next unicorn. There's a huge amount of grit and hard work.
Well, I think the grit and the graft, I mean, they're all points well made, because I suppose in many ways, the conversation about a lot of small firms is not just about let's start it, let's scale it, and let's sell it. I mean, now we seem to be in a much more protracted period where a lot of companies need to show much more resilience, much more time in the field, much more sort of ability to show that they can make it over time. Yet at the same moment that this is happening, of course, we're facing the Collins Dictionary word of the year, the perma crisis. So it's not just a pandemic and the sort of the aftermath of that, but sort of problems wherever you face it. Does hard work, is that enough to see you through, you know, the sort of the potential exhaustion of, you know, problems on so many more fronts than perhaps you've ever had it before?
No, I mean, alone, it's not enough, right? I mean, you have to, you know, it's a kind of prerequisite, right? But being nimble, adjusting, learning, you know, if we look back at 2022, who could have predicted inflation at the levels that we saw? Who could have predicted Russia's invasion of the Ukraine? Who could have predicted our political changes in the UK and a three prime ministers in 1 year? None of us could have predicted it. And so it's about having, now we talk to our businesses about having your North Star. So, you know, whether that's the business plan or the purpose of the business and the values of the business, but you need to adapt, adjust, be very, very, very alive to what your competition is doing, what the broader market is doing. And in our experience, it's those businesses that are nimble that make it. I mean, actually, out of our 10,000 small businesses groups, over 70% changed their business model during the pandemic and were all wildly successful as a result. So there are a whole different number of factors, I think, that go into being a successful entrepreneur. And I think they're definitely common traits.
I think that last point is a very, very interesting one as well, because I was reading some data the other day about how many CEOs, the biggest fear is that their businesses will be seen as redundant or have no more utility or out of date. And that actually that ability to cope and be at the heart of change seems to be at the heart of the survival instinct and the growth instinct.
Well, we know change is the only constant, right? Mm. I mean, I was thinking about this on a personal level last week, because we were doing a collaboration with Multiverse, which is Ewan Blair's organization focusing on skills. And we're having a conversation around, you know, skills in the economy in the context of the great labor shortage. And also the fact that my generation, our generation, we're going to have to work longer, right? And the generations after us are going to have to work longer. And then that throws up a very interesting question of, you know, how do you stay in a workplace that's changing so rapidly? How do you stay relevant? And how do you ensure that you future-proof your skill set so that you're keeping pace with the early 20-year-olds? So,
and what was your answer?
I might actually do a coding course is where I ended up on that. I think, you know, from the perspective of the workplace, and, you know, we're going through a huge generational shift at the moment in terms of what that means.
Yeah, I mean, we may touch on this in a moment, but I mean, that point about differentiating, though, during your career, I mean, that's something you've done through 10,000 women and 10,000 small businesses, and indeed much more widely than that, where I suppose what you're interested in and what you're driven by has also turned out to be what you do for your career. You know, you're not sort of talking for the city or for defense or foreign affairs. You're talking about something as presumably that you're interested in from a starting point. I mean, is this an area that really makes you tick, Charlotte?
In terms of?
Well, just your interest. I mean, I suppose the thing is that, you know, you've got an area that you are excelling in, and it looks like you have a very good feel for it. That's what it comes across to me. I mean, is it the fact that you really believe in these businesses and their ability to affect change that drives your own professional career? Because presumably you could, you know, you're working for a major financial institution. You could have lots of other areas of focus.
You know, I love building things, I think is what motivates me. And therefore I love being a kind of, you know, a ringside spectator to these businesses, you know, building their own, you know, destiny and changing and growing. I find endlessly fascinating, you know. And even kind of, you know, I work for a big financial institution, but even, you know, within it, you know, Goldman is an incredibly entrepreneurial place. So again, there's always the opportunity to build and create, whether that's building a team, whether it's a different area. You know, in my previous career, you know, all the roles that I had, it really was around creating something, you know, finding that white space, right, that no one else is in, and that you can make a meaningful difference.
Right. But it's also, isn't it something about the true space? Because, you know, you've said in the past that it's very important to bring your true and entire self to the workplace, irrespective of whether you're working in a big organization or setting up your own business. What is the true and entire self from your perspective?
Oh, you know, I completely agree with that, right? We have to be authentic.
You said it, Charlotte, so I'm hoping you
I know. Look, I'm a mother of two children. They're young. That matters to me. That's a big part of me. I love my career. I love the UK. And all of that, you know, and I'm not any one of those things. And I don't define myself by my career or working at Goldman. I don't kind of define myself by being a mother. And I love learning and trying different and new experiences. And look, I think it's the combination of all of that that makes you who you are. And I think we're all continuing to grow and develop.
Let's use that growth to flip from matters temporal to matters spiritual, because prior to joining Goldman Sachs, you were chief executive of the Tony Blair Faith Foundation. Tell us a little bit about that role, because we were talking just off air that you didn't approach this from a faith perspective, even with a theology degree under your belt.
Oh, you know, that was the most endlessly fascinating role. So, I mean, you know, yes, I do have a theology degree, and then I did an international relations degree, and then I went and was an investment banker. And then I suddenly found myself working for Tony Blair. This was kind of, you know, at the end of the in a financial crisis, and seconded to him from the bank that I was at the time. And he was setting up his foundation. And to be honest, he didn't have much of an idea at the stage what he wanted it to be, except if you go back, and this was kind of, you know, 2008-09, he was driven by the belief, you know, a clash of civilizations is far too simplistic a term, you know, the old Samuel Huntington phrase, but driven by the belief that religion and its role in society would become ever important, and understanding it, and obviously this coming out of his own experiences with 9/11. And as a leader thereafter, and obviously the London bombings as well. So he had this belief that we weren't recognizing, understanding, and nor were we equipped enough to really deal with religion, religiosity, and extremism in society, which was absolutely born true, because then as we saw what happened with ISIS and the events in the Middle East, you know, if we remember back to those times, you know, religious extremism and the spate of attacks that we had in London was pretty much all consuming for a number of years. And one of the reasons that I love working with him is as a leader and a visionary, you know, he had the ability to, in some ways, you know, see these things before the rest of us did. But also, you know, going back to the point around building, right, building a defense against that religious extremism. So, you know, in the foundation, we did a huge amount of, you know, education in some of the most difficult areas, you know, around the world. So whether that's, you know, Northern Nigeria, across the Middle East and Pakistan, to really help and engage with, you know, different religious groups, understanding the other.
Did it help or hinder your role that, you know, you didn't, as we've spoken about, you didn't approach this from a position of personal faith, but presumably Tony Blair did. I mean, I'm thinking about the famous David Frost interview where he asked him whether he and George Bush prayed together. And it was the first time that he kind of, he revealed that. And then I was thinking about Alistair Campbell saying, well, we don't do God as a sort of important emblem of the government of that time. I'm just wondering what the vibe was, you know, between, you know, somebody who clearly had a approach this from a perspective of personal faith, and actually you coming in as chief exec of a foundation where you're wanting to help it make a difference.
To be honest, I think it absolutely helped. And also, I mean, that was a question that Tony was asked a lot, you know, again and again and again, you know, whether it was a faith motivation for him. And I you know, it was much more a geopolitical motivation, right, and a kind of intellectual motivation. You know, he would always again talk about, you know, faith being in some senses a private matter to, you know, help guide the person, but actually with whatever endeavor you have, and, you know, in my case, I found it, you know, incredibly helpful to be able to bring a rational, you know, view to really how to build the organization, think about the organization, whilst obviously appreciating and understanding, you know, other people's perspectives. So it was, it was a really fascinating period.
I bet. And maybe I'm trying to thread this all together, Charlotte, in a way that is a good representation or not, but I noticed in your lockdown list that Shadowlands by C.S. Lewis is your chosen read, and of course, you know, it tells the tale of two incredibly, you know, divergent lives: the Christian scholar in C.S. Lewis and Joy Davidson, the Jewish American divorcee and former Communist Party member. But of course, a lot of it is also about the crisis of faith and the crisis of loss. And I wondered, you know, thinking about having worked for somebody who, you know, I suppose gained certainty from being a kind of political Marmite character, as in those that, you know, those that bought into him and those that didn't. Is there more in your own view about this, which questions, there's more questioning, I suppose. Is it more about the fragility of people and actually the questioning of things like faith that are what makes us human? I don't know. Is that a fair question?
Yeah, you know, I love this book and also the film. And I remember watching it first when I was actually very, very young. And it was really the first time that I'd, in such a profound way, and I highly recommend it to anyone, encountered and really thought about those feelings of intense love and then grief and then loss and then how to deal with loss. And it's been my mother, who I was incredibly close to, died last year after a very difficult battle with cancer. And so I think I kept coming back to C.S. Lewis and that narrative of love and loss and that kind of uncertainty. And there's a lovely quote in the book, which is, you know, we live in the shadowlands. The sun is always shining somewhere else, round a bend in the road or over the bow of a hill. It always stuck with me and struck me and taught me again to live in the present and to look, to look for that sunshine and in the present. So yes, you know, let me put it another way. I'd love to be religious. And I've really tried throughout my whole theology degree, which was a wonderful degree, but I'm just not. But I think that hope and that framework that it gives people, I'm very helpful.
I also think that explains your hopes for the next 10 years, is that they're going to be the best yet. I think it's
they are, Michael.
The let's talk about some of that sunshine, because I think your best tips for life were great. I don't know if you've got them in front of you, because you had a few. Do you want me to sort of read them out? Sleep on it. No one else cares about what you care about in the same way you do. Believe in yourself. Drink water when you wake up. Anything you want to leave us with on those?
You know what? A good night's sleep always puts everything in perspective, 100%. And, you know, we're kind of, sounds depressing, right? But we're kind of alone on this planet, you know? So, like, believe in yourself, push yourself forward. you know, recognize I've come up with too many situations where you think people are coming from the same perspective as yourself, or they care about something as much as you do, or in the same way you do. And most of the time they really don't. Mm. And actually understanding that, I think, sets about how you approach things in a very different way. And Michael, I mean, you were the best, right? When you also drink water first thing in the morning. And actually I learned it from a very inspirational female leader here at Goldman, Asahi Pompei. You know, the first thing she does is drink water every day, and you refer to it as like having a shower for your insides.
Totally right.
And I really like that.
Mainly, it was only water that I drank. But let's move on, because I mean, you know, five great tracks. In fact, you had six of them because you included Silence. But I'm thinking about your playlist of Ennio Morricone, Dusty Springfield, ABBA, Elgar, to name but a few. I mean, there's a lot of different vibes in there, Charlotte. Is that sort of reflecting the eclectic personality?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, I love, you know, all of those are kind of significant, like, moments or, like, experiences. Oh, I just really like them, right? Like, I just really, you know, I mean, ABBA's Winner Takes It All is just really fun. And then you go to Elgar's Nimrod, and I just think it's one of the most beautiful pieces of music. You know, I spend a lot of time in Worcestershire and on the Malvern Hills, which is where he wrote it. And it's just, you know, beauty at its best. Me.
Absolutely. Now, let's finish off with, I think, is a cracking favourite quote from Blaise Pascal. I didn't have time to write a short letter, so I wrote a long one instead. Well said. What does it mean to you?
I absolutely love this. I remember going into, it was Saatchi's offices, and I was many, many, many years ago. And on the wall, they had emblazoned, you know, the brutal art of simplicity. And it's so true. Right, if you can say something in a few words, it's so much more powerful than the extended waffle. And it also ensures a discipline of mind, a discipline of thought. And so it's been a guiding, and then I look at all the people that are really successful around me, and kind of without fail, right, they're all just extraordinary communicators with that ability to get an idea across very simply.
It's a skill.
It's a real skill, one of which I wish I was better at, but I kind of hold as my kind of guiding professional star, because it's all powerful. And again, if you look at all the great, you know, the political figures or the key business figures, you know, their ability to communicate complex ideas simply and succinctly is incredibly, incredibly important.
Well, I suppose there are some times where I might think if we had more time, I'd make it shorter. But in this instance, Charlotte, I wish we had longer, but alas, we haven't. So thank you so much for joining me on Changemakers. And thanks so much for sharing your brilliant story.
Thank you. I loved it. Thank you for having me, Michael.
Changemakers is brought to you by the campaigns firm Seven Hills and presented by me, Michael Heyman. Pure Being is the name of our soundtrack, and it's written and performed by the brilliant BT Wolf. To find out more, head over to changemakers.works, and if you like what you hear, why not give us a rating?